104.3. Always on the cutting edge. Voice of the Cape, drive time. Welcome back to the show. That time of the week when we have our book review, and in my hand is a book entitled These Are Not Gentle People, A True Story. The author is Andrew Harding, in South Africa, a well-known BBC journalist who has also written The Acclaimed Mayor of Mogadishu, has been a foreign correspondent for BBC in the Soviet Union, Asia, Kenya, and for the past 10 years in South Africa. Now, what are we having a look at here? It's an interesting book because it looks like a novel, it feels like a novel, it reads like a novel, but it is a true story. And a special welcome to Andrew Harding.
Hello, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, this is probably one of the more interesting books I've read this year, most definitely. Technically speaking, how did you manage to write this book? You're dealing with a whole host of people, and you very cleverly managed to get them onto the pages, sometimes without directly quoting them. Just tell us how you managed to get this all together.
Oh, that's a big, long question. I suppose I sort of surrendered myself to the process because I was looking in early 2016 for a true crime that I could follow the whole case of. And I'd heard about this incident in the Free State, and I went down for the bail hearings and pretty quickly got hooked and decided basically to latch myself on to that and talk to everybody I could find involved. Some people didn't want to talk, but a lot of people, I think, felt, well, okay, let's see where this goes. And I promised everyone that I wouldn't use their interviews, use the material, until after the murder trial, the double murder trial, was over. And that trial dragged on for years and years. And I suppose it was time, to some extent, that gave people confidence to talk to me and to open up, and really open up. And then once I transcribed perhaps a million words of interviews and of court transcripts, I set about trying to craft it into, as you say, into something that felt like a novel. So I quote people. I don't put words in anybody's mouth, but obviously I try and shape the material so that it feels like a real drama, a real thriller.
I mean, it certainly comes across this way, and of course, the core of the events we're talking about are two young men, Samuel and Simon. Samuel feels he's owed money, and he feels that Bouta van der Westhuizen owes him this money, 2,000 rand, and it kind of starts from there, doesn't it? It's a typical farm violence kind of a scenario, isn't it? But it unravels in a dramatic fashion, doesn't it?
It's typical in some ways, it's very unusual in other ways. Because you say, it started in January 2016 when an elderly white farmer, Ludi van der Westhuizen, pressed his panic button and said he'd been robbed or attacked by these two, possibly three, young black men. And his neighbours, his relatives, all the other farmers in the district all came running in their cars with their guns to hunt for these young men. And I guess that's in a way that the unresolved mystery at the heart of the book, or one of them, is that, you know, was this a farm attack by these two black farm workers, Simon and Samuel, or was this a wage dispute that went terribly wrong? And it's a crucial aspect of the story, and it becomes, as you can imagine, heavily politicized in the community. And it's one of the many ambiguities in the book. And the men, the white farmers who then chase down Simon and Samuel and capture them, are so angry about the situation with farm murders, farm attacks, that they proceed to assault them brutally for several hours. And the following morning, the two men are dead. So was it murder? Was it a beating gone wrong? What happened in that field? And which of the farmers should take responsibility for it? That's what the rest of the book starts to try and unravel.
And of course, I mean, it must have been quite frustrating in a sense. Obviously, we don't want to give too much away because people must buy the book. But there's a lot of unresolved issues probably is the incorrect way of expressing it, but there's certainly, at the end of the read, one is certainly left with a huge amount of question marks of, like, what happened?
Exactly. And I guess one of the luxuries of writing this as a novel, as a non-fiction narrative, is that I don't have necessarily to deliver that aha moment. I can wallow, if you like, in the ambiguities of it and let, hopefully, the reader come to their own decisions. I mean, I've got some pretty clear ideas about whether it was a farm attack or not, and about who was to blame and who should carry the can. But I try to kind of keep my distance, if you like.
Mm. Was it easy or difficult to keep a distance? Because there's a wide range of people that you spoke to, and in fact you helpfully mention all their names in the beginning of the book. You spoke to people in town, in court, in the township, and on the farms. It's a wide range of people. I mean that process in itself.
Well, one thing that struck me very early on was that in court, the two black men, Simon and Samuel, were almost erased. Their identities were muddled by the police, by the prosecution, by the judge. There was no real attempt to kind of respect them as humans, as individuals. And so I felt very strongly that I needed, for this to be a proper story, to bring those two men back to life. So I spent a lot of time talking to their families, particularly to Ruth Kokota, the mother of Samuel Chika. And she was, you know, very brave and very open about her life story and about her son. And in a way, what I hope the book does is allow these two really kind of divided communities who live, you know, orbiting around each other on these farms, black and white. I wanted to kind of give a sense of what a moment like this, an incident like this, looks from the other side.
Indeed, I mean, yes, yes.
Yeah. Now,
I think you do that quite successfully. I mean, the story of Ruth is a stark contrast to sort of the lifestyles and the worldview of some of the farmers, as it is opposed to some of the outsiders who come in, like the Hawks and the various prosecutors and defense attorneys. I mean, Ruth is a tragic figure in the book, isn't she? Living this nondescript life and thrust into the limelight in the most tragic and brutal of fashions.
She is. I mean, she's a widowed, mother of three boys, and Samuel, the son who died, was very much the breadwinner of the family, the most responsible figure, who really stepped up to look after Ruth. And so when he died, she was pretty much left on her own. And yet, despite that, I mean, she's a very sort of warm and courageous, as I say, figure. And so I wanted to kind of do her justice in the book. And, you know, I hope I have.
No, I mean, well, look, I've read the book. I can advise our listeners, you have. And she's one of the sort of the stark characters in the book, because the way in which you explain the way that she has to live in comparison to others in the book. An interesting sort of junction in the book is the magistrate Leshni Pillay, who is on the case and then she's off the case, and how the community responded to her. An Indian judge or magistrate catapulted into a town like Parais in the Orange Free State. Sort of a South African question there in every sense of the word.
Exactly. I mean, Leshni Pillay was one of the reasons I really started to believe early on that I had chosen a good story to follow, because, as I say, it was really a gamble to be writing and researching and committing myself to this book. The trial could have gone any way. It could have been thrown out. It could have ended in a mistrial. It could have dragged on for another 5 years. But Leshni Pillay, very, very outspoken, very angry Indian South African, who felt that Paris, when she first arrived, had treated her with contempt as an outsider. Then she'd come to kind of begin to fit in slowly. But when this bail hearing happened after the death of these two men, suddenly she's thrust into the spotlight because there's huge political pressure from the ANC locally on her to deny these white farmers bail, because the ANC in particular was looking to make some political capital out of this ahead of local elections. And Pillay was very outspoken to me, very forthright, kept saying, this is outrageous, I'm going to do this right, there's no evidence against these men so far, so of course they deserve bail, but kept saying, this is becoming like Zimbabwe, I refuse to let South Africa go that way, I'm going to stick up for the law, and so on. So she, you know, when she started talking to me, I realized, well, maybe I can get inside this story. Maybe people will let me in to tell, you know, this very complicated tale.
No, I mean, complicated it is, but it is a good read, and it's very accessible the way that you've written it. I was fascinated to see the defense team. It was pretty much of an A-team, a guy called Corbus Burger, who had a very black and white look at life. Everything was BS. Barry Roux, playing his cameo part, well-known in the Oscar Pistorius trial. Another lawyer called Nick O'Dreyer, who's passed on, and an old man called Hans de Brain. Quite an interesting team. They added a lot of color to the story, I must admit.
They did, and I mean, of course, it was great to catch up with Barry Roux, who I'd come to know quite well during the Oscar Pistorius trial, and in fact, he was covering the Pistorius trial that gave me, I mean, it's fairly obvious insight, but it gave me this insight into quite how fascinating a long court process can be. I'd never, as a foreign correspondent, I'd never really covered a trial from beginning to end, and I pretty much soon after covering that, I realized that was the kind of story I wanted to tell and was looking for. And yes, then Barry cropped up briefly in this story as the Van der Vestes and farming clan starts to split apart, and the unity of these white farmers in the face of these political and hawks investigations and allegations starts to crumble. And then from there, this extraordinary trial that, even though it sort of was drizzled out piecemeal over, you know, more than 3 years, actually at the heart of it, just fascinating legal battles and dramas, you know, two different types of justice, with the prosecution basically saying, look, we've caught some of the guys who beat up these two men. Two men died, all these farmers beat them. Surely natural justice would suggest that, even if the evidence about who exactly did what to whom, surely we've got some of them, they need to be sentenced for double murder. Whereas the defense arguing, as you'd expect, that no, reasonable doubt is there, you've got to be able to prove exactly which farmer did exactly what to which of these two black bodies. And that set the scene for this extraordinarily difficult decision for the judge to make.
Indeed, and we're going to leave that one for the reader. Then we've got Captain Henk Prinsloo, a community police officer, who is very typical of what we're dealing with. He was fingered for allegedly using a taser in the groin of one of the two black youths that were killed. But the question is, did he or did he not? Was the battery in the taser or not? That becomes quite a fascinating little cameo. And of course, what happens to Captain Henk Prinsloo? His career goes down in flames.
And he very much, and the white community in Paris, very much see him as the kind of sacrificial political lamb, that he has been pulled out by the hawks who come tearing into town under orders from very high up to crack this case, this racist double murder as they see it, and they believe that the local police are somehow in on it, complicit, that they've given these white farmers too much leeway, and they are very quick to arrest Henk Prinsloo, and as you say, to put him on trial for double murder, for this very murky, disputed tale of him using allegedly a taser on at least one, if not both, of the two victims.
Indeed, and of course the Hawks come into town. I mean, we're talking about real people, but it's the Hawks of old, I'll put it that way, because they make some elementary mistakes, the mistakes that you pointed out in the beginning. They themselves didn't seem to be too sure of who was who, whether it was Samuel or whether it was Simon.
Well, exactly. And they aren't at all interested in finding out whether Simon and Samuel had tried to rob old Ludi or whether it was a wage dispute. Of course, it didn't suit them in terms of focusing on a double murder investigation to look too closely at that. And that, of course, enrages the white farmers, who say they're biased, that their concerns, their fears as farmers out there, outside Paris, are not being taken seriously enough. And as they argue, we gave these two men a beating, which they feel was the least they should deserve, having attacked one of them. But they say that it was not murder, it was a beating, and then who knows what happened to the unconscious bodies of the two black men as they were taken away from the field in the back of a police car. Maybe something else happened afterwards.
Yeah, and again, we'll leave that for the reader, because that also becomes a fascinating avenue in the book. And of course, you mentioned, I mean, politics is at the forefront, isn't it? It's ANC dominated, but the EFF, the Red Boys, also come in as well. I mean, there's a Paul Tabani from the EFF activist who also plays a part.
Yes, he's a great character, and it allowed me to try and portray, and I think it's true, to portray Paris and Tumahole, the township, as something of a microcosm of South Africa. But what I found interesting is, although I was sort of drawn in initially by the politics, by the political pressure on the trial, on the bail hearing, actually over the years that fell away, and what I was left with was a much more, to me, intriguing story about the community itself, free of the political kind of cynical political machinations on the outside, and really the story about this very divided family and this very divided community.
No, absolutely. And of course, I mean, a lot of people are saying this is a typical of South Africa. That's a difficult judgment call, isn't it? Because I'm sure you'll agree, as a foreign correspondent here, there are a number of little South Africas that you can find right across the country, although Paris certainly is one of the narratives.
It is. You know, I talk about it being a microcosm. It's not, of course. Nowhere can sum up a country. But it's a tourist town. It's got wealth and prosperity. This is not some, you know, wretched, crumbling, dusty farming town that, you know, that really is on the way down. Paris has all sorts of things going on for it. And what was striking to me as an outsider coming in is quite how those strata, if you like, of history, of society, are still very so visible clearly, from the community retirement homes along the Vaal River through to the old Afrikaner dorp, then the gap, sort of old apartheid gap between Paris and the township with its, you know, some of its prosperity, some of its struggles, then the informal settlement on the edge of it where Simon and Samuel used to live, these wretched tin shacks. Then you've got the wannabe commercial black farmers with their tiny little plots and their sheep and their goats. Then you have these white elephant projects that the, you know, the authorities over the years have tried to start up, but all of them have failed, these chicken farms and so on. And then beyond that, you have the white farmers, the commercial farmers, all of them white, the 50 members of the local farmers' union, stretching out into the forever.
No, absolutely. And we have to leave it there, but our Reddy Klabi has got something on the cover of the book. She says, a gripping and painful read, told with empathy and nuance. These are not gentle people is an uncomfortable reminder that the past is not over. It is a recommended read, that's for sure. These are not gentle people, a true story. Picador Africa is the publisher. And of course, These Are Not the Gentle People is at a bookstore near you. Andrew Harding, well done, and may the book fly off the shelves.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.